There is one section in the Messiah that there are a number of beautiful numbers in it that I really enjoyed, but the one that I want to refer to today in relationship to this sermon is that statement that's made there from Malachi, where the question is being asked, who will stand at the day of his appearing? And I got to thinking, who will stand? When that day comes, who will stand when he appeareth? Well, there's probably many Bible examples we could use to answer that question, but I wanted to confine it to one of the Psalms today. Psalm 15. So let's go down through this psalm today. I intended to bring the Living Bible, and I forgot it and left it home. If anybody's got a copy of it, I wouldn't mind taking a look at it, because I would read it also. Do we have any volunteers that has a Living Bible here? You mean to tell me we don't have anybody here that reads the Living Bible? Well, when you get home, if you get a copy of it or if you have one, read it in the Living Bible. It is much more modernized, so it makes it a little bit more understandable, but it's understandable enough even as it is in the King James Version here. So here's what we read, beginning in Psalm 15, verse 1. The question is being asked here, Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? This is asking the question, who's going to gain eternal life and be in God's kingdom? That's what it's talking about. In other words, who's going to really stand when he appeareth? So then it goes on to define here the characteristics that are required if one is going to abide in God's tabernacle and dwell in his holy hill. So here's the first one. He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness. So here we're talking about somebody that walketh uprightly. We have a phrase we have all heard at one time or another when we talk about somebody that he's upset in some manner, and we say, well, he's all bent over. Now, that's sort of a play on words, but it does illustrate a point, because if someone is walking uprightly, he obviously is not bent over, is he? And uprightly, in this sense, means righteousness. Here we have the word right, found right within this word. So here's one that is walking in a right manner, and he is working righteousness. That's the very first thing that's mentioned here. Now notice Jesus' statement here in Matthew 5, verse number 6. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness. Righteousness simply means right doing. And right is defined in the Bible as obedience to God's commandments and God's law. So the very first requirement that is laid forth here is the matter of one walking in accordance with God's law and God's commandments. The book of Ezekiel, chapter 18, verse number 5, makes a rather terse statement here, but it is right to the point. And this is what it says. If a man be just and do that which is lawful and right. I won't go on to define here what he is listing here as a number of things included, but I just want to give the statement here that if a man is just, he will do that which is lawful and right. Lawful means within the confines of God's law, and righteousness then is in accordance with right doing defined by God's commandments. Psalm 119, verse 172, we have the Bible definition for righteousness. And if this is a text you need to memorize and have in your mind, this is it. At least the latter part of the verse. My tongue shall speak of thy word. And here's the part that defines righteousness. For all thy commandments are righteousness. So if we're talking about walking uprightly and doing righteousness, then what it's talking about is living by the commandments and the laws of God. Psalm 37, verse number 30. The mouth of the righteous speaketh wisdom, and his tongue talketh of judgment. But here's the verse we want to get to in verse 31. The law of his God is in his heart. None of his steps shall slide. If he's walking uprightly, then he's not all bent over or he's out of shape and he's going to get lost in any direction. He's an individual, as it says here, that his steps shall not slide, and the law of God is in his heart. That's what keeps him from sliding. So by the Bible definition here then, as we read back here in Psalm 15, he that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness, we're really talking about someone who is a commandment keeper, who is God-fearing, and who tries to live by every word of God to the best of his ability. Now that's the first thing that's mentioned here. Now what does it say for the second thing? And speaketh the truth in his heart. Whatever is in his heart, this is what he's going to be speaking. This then is defining someone who is not hypocritical. Now the Bible is full of many admonitions of people who say one thing and they mean something else. So this is talking about someone who then is totally sincere. It's like when Nathanael approached Jesus and Jesus said, "Behold, an Israelite in whom there is no guile." He could see here was a man that was totally honest. And this is really talking about honesty is what it's talking about. It's talking about someone who what he feels, that's what he's speaking. Now, there might be individuals that have a wrong spirit and a wrong attitude. And maybe they need to change that attitude, and they need to change the spirit that is within them, but at least they're honest in what they say. And this is far better off than somebody who puts on, he masquerades in a certain manner, but that's not really what he thinks, and that's not really what he believes. The Bible is saying here in plain language, if anyone is ever going to be in God's kingdom, he's going to have to be an honest person. Now let's notice Matthew 12, verse number 35. This is what Jesus said. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth good things. Because his heart speaks what's there. And an evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. See, as he said in verse 34, O generation of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. Really, in a sense, the mouth is almost a spokesman for the soul. And people are going to speak, sooner or later, they're going to speak what's on their mind. But when you find somebody who is deceptive, and who is deceitful, and who is dishonest, fundamentally dishonest in what he thinks, and what he says in relationship to what he thinks, then this is a person that God says, in plain language, he'll not be in his kingdom. Notice Psalm 51. This is what God desires in all men. David wrote it concerning himself because of the problem with which he was involved, from which he very sorely repented. But as we read here in Psalm 51, verse number 6, Behold, thou desireth truth in the inward parts. That means in the heart, which is figurative for the mind, the attitude, the mode of life that the person really lives and believes. What God wants to see is truth then down in the innermost parts of that man. And that truth is defined by God's word, and then that man being honest enough to really live up to it. Proverbs 12, verse 19. The lips of truth shall be established forever. So here's a man that's honest. He has God's truth down in his heart and mind. He's not deceitful or hypocritical. He's not a phony. And he is living it. All right, the lip of truth shall be established forever. But notice by contrast, a lying tongue is but for a moment. That's how long falsehood lasts. But that which is truthful will stand and continue to stand and remain so. Jeremiah 5, verse number 3. O Lord, are not thine eyes upon the truth? See, nothing is hidden from God. And no matter how dishonest a person may be, God knows what's in his heart and mind anyway. He may deceive other human beings, and he may continue to exist for a good bit of time deceiving other human beings, but he hasn't hidden anything from God for one moment. This is why, really, God is only the one that is capable of judging, because God's the one that really knows what's in the heart and mind. Now, people do often make mistakes of misjudgment because they see individuals, they even hear individuals say certain things, and then they draw conclusions in their own minds as to what they think that person said, when again, that may not have been what the person intended. That's why we really are not in a position to judge anything. Only God is capable of doing that, because he knows what's in the very depths of the heart and mind and what that person's thinking, what the attitude is. God's the one that looks at truth. But we do read here in Leviticus 19, verse number 11, you shall not steal, and what I want to emphasize here is this next portion of the verse, neither deal falsely. Neither deal falsely. There are people who just, their lifestyle is one of falsehood. They couldn't be honest and speak an honest word if their lives depended on it. And you just have to recognize that here is an Old Testament law that even had to do with dealing in an honest manner with your fellow man. So again, it does demonstrate the Bible emphasis to always be one who is sincere and honest in what you say and what you think. Now, sometimes it might not be best to say what you think, frankly. You know, maybe the truth would be too brutal. And in that case, you'd be better off just to keep your mouth shut, not say anything, or defer not to say anything. But, you know, as we'll see here, one of these next points coming up here has to do with how you say it also, because that's also an important factor. But let's go, before we go to that, let's go to Psalm 5, verse number 6 here. Here's what God says about people who are false, and this is the bottom line as far as he is concerned. Thou shalt destroy them that speak leasing. And you see the word leasing here? The Jewish translation says falsehood. You shall destroy them that speak falsehood. So when you have a person whose lifestyle is one of fundamental and basic dishonesty, this is going to be the end. That's why the emphasis back here in this psalm is one that speaketh the truth in his heart. He has the truth and he lives up to it, and he's not hypocritical. He does not feign to be what he is not. Then the next point we read here concerning these characteristics, these requirements that God lays upon us if we wish to be in his kingdom. Verse number 3, he that backbiteth not with his tongue. Now, what do we mean by backbiting? Well, I suppose if you've ever seen animals fight, you know, well, you've seen backbiting. Because if one of them manages to get on top of the other one on his back, he'll try to chew him apart. I remember one time we had this old striped cat. He was a mean thing. And we never did have him neutered or anything, and he only lived for two things. But anyway, he was staring. I looked out the back porch one day and out the window, and he was staring at something, just intently staring at it. I wondered, what the world's he staring at? And I stuck out my head a little bit further, and there was a big Persian cat about 6 feet away from me, and they were having this stare down. Boy, I tell you, if those two would have gotten into it, it would have really been a brawl. And so I decided to run him out of there, so I opened the door, and that was before my little dog got blind and deaf. I said, sick him, and she ran out the door. And she got out there, and that cat, that Persian, got distracted. And he started looking over at the little dog, and about that time, this striped cat of mine landed right up in the top of that cat's back, and I'll tell you, the fur just went. I mean, fur just scattered everywhere. And between the two of them, that cat hightailed it for the fence and ran for his life. That was a typical example. I'll never forget it when they talk about the fur flying. That was really it. But it does show, you know, I guess the word backbiting comes from that thing where animals will jump on each other's back and try to bite or claw one another apart. But the word actually means, in the Hebrew, and it would be the same meaning in the English, backbite means to say mean or spiteful things. To say mean or spiteful things. You get upset or you get angry. We've all done it from time to time, haven't we? You get angry at somebody and then you just let it fly. Whatever comes to your mind, you just let it fly, no matter how mean and spiteful it is. That's backbiting. So what this text is telling us here, we had better get to the place in our lives where we get enough self-control that we don't do that. No matter how upset we may get. So here's what it says. He that backbiteth not with his tongue. What that means is that he does not say mean and spiteful things when he gets upset or angry. Because in reality, it's a lack of self-control is what it is. I guess it shows you, you know, you stop and think of yourself in that light. It makes us all realize how much we've got to grow yet and overcome, doesn't it? Let's notice some texts now to talk about that. Let's go to Psalm 140 and verse 11. Let not an evil speaker be established on the earth. Now, would you say that somebody that's backbiting with his tongue would be regarded in the sight of God as an evil speaker? I would think so. And what does God say? Let not an evil speaker be established in the earth. So, you know, what that simply means is that people in that category who never overcome that, they never master that, and they go through life that way, they'll never be in God's kingdom. That's what it means in plain language. They will not be established on the earth. Proverbs 11 and verse 9, a hypocrite with his tongue destroys his neighbor. Now, there may be many ways that that text is applicable, all right, but let's just approach it from the point of view of saying mean and spiteful things against his neighbor. That just simply means against his fellow man. A person who never gives his neighbor or his fellow man the benefit of the doubt. A person who always looks for the evil and never for the good. One who's always busy fault-finding and being critical rather than being understanding and patient. That's a person who's going to say mean and spiteful things. That's why the text says here that he destroys his neighbor with his mouth. And you'll find that people do that all the time. They'll say one thing to your face and then they'll say something else behind your back. You've had that happen. Maybe you've done the same thing. Proverbs 26, verse number 24. He that hateth, in other words, here's somebody that really hates his neighbor, dissembles with his lips. In other words, his lips are going to be something that are going to cause unrest. Sure, a marginal rendering says be known, but the very fact that he does that kind of speaking is going to call attention to what he's doing to somebody else. Have you ever had somebody do that to you? Then all sooner or later it'll come wafting back. It's not a very pleasant experience, is it? Well, if that's the way it affects us, we surely wouldn't want to do that to somebody else, would we? So we must recognize it is important that we do not say mean and spiteful things about other people. 1 Peter 2, verse number 1. Here's a good text that would, in a broad sense, certainly apply to this category. Then so here's an admonition from Peter in the New Testament. Wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisies and envies and all evil speakings. I'll tell you, the Bible says if a man can control his tongue, he's a perfect man. Perfect. Man can control and tame all kinds of things, but this little small piece of flesh in one's mouth, he cannot control. Well, you see, the problem really isn't the tongue. The tongue is just simply the instrument of the mind. So the problem is really the attitude in the mind is what it is. The tongue just simply does what the mind tells it to do. So that's where the real problem lies. So let's remember then, as we're admonished here, one who's going to be in God's kingdom does not backbite with his tongue. Next, what does he do? Nor doeth evil to his neighbor. Do you think there are people that would do evil to their neighbor? That just means your fellow man. Because remember, when Jesus gave the example of the Samaritan, the good Samaritan, you know, this man was left crippled and he was asking, the original question was, who is my neighbor? And then Jesus illustrated the point. The neighbor, your neighbor from the Bible viewpoint is your fellow man. Whatever set of circumstances in which you may find yourself in relationship with your fellow man, that's your neighbor. So what does it say here then? He does not do evil to his neighbor. You ever had somebody do something evil to you? It isn't very pleasant, is it? Do you think people actually practiced evil things against other people? Well, that's what every burglary is. That's what every robbery is. That's what vandalism is. You know, the list could go on endless. People sometimes will go into somebody's home to burglarize it, and then just out of pure spite, they'll just wreck everything that's in the home. Is that doing evil to your neighbor? I'll guarantee you, somebody like that will never be in God's kingdom. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So it isn't our responsibility and obligation to take all of our frustrations and problems out on other people. That's God's responsibility. And when you find people who do this, the Bible says in plain language, they're not qualifying for God's kingdom and they'll never be there. Now, again, there are a number of texts that deal with this subject. Let's go to the book of Psalms. Psalm 28, verse number 3. Psalm 28 and verse number 3. Draw me not away with the wicked and with the workers of iniquity, which speak peace with their neighbors, but mischief is in their hearts. They say one thing, but they really don't mean it. They really have a heart that is mischievous. And they look for some opportunity where they can do some other person dirt. And when an opportunity comes, they seize upon it. You see, that's the kind of thing that God condemns. In many cases, somebody that's just absolutely innocent, not even involved. Proverbs 16, verse number 27. An ungodly man diggeth up evil. It isn't a matter of just going out and finding it. He's got to dig it up and generate problems. And it's because there's an evil heart and an evil attitude down deep inside of that person. They can't see the good in anything. All they can do is see the evil and be critical and fault-finding in everything they do. Well, that's a very sad spectacle of a human being that's made in God's image, because human beings are not to do that. They're to make an effort to think good, not evil. Titus 2, verse number 3. In this case, it's talking about aged women, but it could be applicable to anybody who may be guilty of this very thing. But what does it say here? One of the characteristics it says here is not false accusers. Not false accusers. Now, who's generally is a false accuser? I'll tell you who a false accuser is. A false accuser is generally somebody that's in a wrong spirit and a wrong attitude and is critical and fault-finding all the time. They don't have a positive orientation to their lives. Their orientation is negative. And so they think negatively about everything and about everything that everybody else does. And they'll be very quick to find fault and to accuse. God condemns that kind of thing. James 1, verse number 26. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is vain. So a false accuser is a person who has a fundamentally wrong attitude to begin with and then does not control his tongue right along with it. That's why we read here in James 4, verse number 11. Speak not evil one of another, brethren. You know, particularly against church members. where church members accuse and find fault against other church members. That's one of the worst things you can get into. Christ said that his disciples would be known by the love that they have for one another. And when you find somebody that exemplifies that kind of a attitude, you're not looking at a person that has any love. And I think I'd go one step further. You're not looking at a real Christian either. You're looking at somebody who's pretending to be one. Real Christianity does not practice that. Do not speak evil of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. He set himself above the law is what he's done. God's going to be the one to do the judging, no human being. So we really don't have a right to sit in judgment of others, do we? And to make false accusations. Now, right along with that, what do we read here? It's rather interesting because when you go down through these points here in this 15th Psalm, how many do you have? 10. Just like you have 10 commandments, you have 10 characteristics here that God outlines. And what is the next one here? Nor taketh up reproach against his neighbor. Here's somebody that is actually on the offensive, and he's making it an effort, a bona fide effort, to create problems and disaster for his neighbor, and saying things about him. You know, maybe they might be true. But, you know, you have to ask yourself this question, you know, is it really worth peace to let a lot of things slide? If your neighbors do things that are upsetting and disturbing, how much is peace worth? Now, maybe sometimes it isn't worth it. Maybe the agony that you're suffering isn't worth peace, and maybe in that case you'll have to make an action. But in general, most of the time when people get upset about their neighbors, it's the end result of a long series of things, and then it's a little small thing that'll set it off. If you live in a neighborhood where you have rented homes, you know, you're more prone to see that than if you live in areas where you have long settled neighbors that have been there a long time. Because you have often the types of people that come in rented homes in areas that are just, they're kind of transient, and they're not the kind of people that are really interested in the neighborhood, and so they don't really take an interest in maintaining peace, and they'll do a lot of things that are out of line. And they'll generate problems, that's true, in a lot of cases. But regardless of that, what God says here, as far as we're concerned, we're not to be a person that gets involved in those things and takes up a reproach against his neighbor. It simply means against your fellow man. Exodus 23, verse number 1. Thou shalt not raise a false report. And as the Hebrew actually implies here, when I went through this some time ago, it simply means that you're cherishing, or you are uttering, or you're offering the fact that you have very suspicions about somebody. If you talk about all the suspicions you have about people, I mean, you know, you could talk endlessly about every human being on the face of the earth, couldn't you? But what about yourself? So, you know, what it's simply saying here is it's best to leave those things to yourself. Verse number 7 says, keep thee far from a false matter. Sometimes you'll see eruptions occur in neighborhoods, and people will even try to get you to take sides on things. And you're better off really, unless it's a major problem and affects you directly, you're better off keep out of it, frankly, in most cases. But you would have to weigh it on the circumstances and all that's involved, so you'd have to be the judge of that. But in general, what it's telling us here is that we should not be the kind of a person that gets involved in some kind of defensive thing, taking up something contrary against our fellow man, taking up a reproach where we're repeating things and generating gossip and slander and what's all involved in that. Leviticus 19, verse number 16. You shall not go up as a talebearer among your people. Would that be taking up a reproach against your neighbor? I believe it would. Luke 3, verse 14. Here's an admonition that even preceded Christ's ministry. This time, a statement given by John the Baptist, but it pretty well summarizes it. This is in Luke 3, Verse number 14. John the Baptist was speaking to the people in his day, and this is what he said. The soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, "What shall we do?" Because John was giving these various admonitions. And there were Roman soldiers standing around there, and they said, "Well, what should we do?" And here's what his answer was. "Do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely." Don't be a false accuser. That's certainly a way of taking up a reproach against your neighbor. And the problem with a lot of people is, you know, I don't say how many necessarily among us, I'm just talking about people in general, is, and that is that they will see something and they'll interpret it in their own eyes, and then they'll make an accusation when that may not have been what was behind it at all. I remember years ago we saw a film. It was an instructional film in the ministry, and it was entitled In the Eyes of the Beholder. And it gave a set of circumstances, and then three or four different people all saw it. And then they all came before the judge and gave their version of it, as opposed to what really had happened. And I mean, their versions of it were just as outlandish as it could be, because they simply were interpreting it on the basis of what they thought they saw. And it wasn't the case at all. And that's what people do. They will tend, you know, you go to a court trial, and somebody will stand up and they'll give their version of a certain incident, and then the next party will stand up and he'll give his version of the incident, and the two of them are as far as they can be away from being joined. Because people interpret events in the light of their experiences and the way they think they see it. And if you do that and then you make all kinds of accusations along with it, is that taking up a reproach against your neighbor? It certainly is. That's accusing somebody falsely. And in 2 Timothy 3, here's one of the characteristics of the last days in which we live. It lists a whole series of things here which are responsible for the perilous times in which we live. And what are one of the things mentioned here in verse number 3? False accusers. False accusers. You know, men have had their entire reputations and their entire livelihood ruined and wrecked on the basis of a false accusation. That's why it's such a serious offense in the sight of God. A person is a whole lot better off just to not make any accusations, really. Certainly, than to make false ones. Going back to this 15th Psalm, we read here, continuing, here's another characteristic of a righteous man that will stand in God's kingdom and in his right to be worthy of that kingdom. Verse 4, in whose eyes a vile person is contemned. What does that word contemned mean? It means despised, disregarded. In whose eyes a vile person is despised or disregarded, utterly disregarded. In other words, he will have no stamp of approval, and he will give no stamp of approval, nor will he condone a vile person. Now notice, here's one of the Psalms. In fact, the very first Psalm really summarizes it right in the first verse. This is what a righteous man will do in the sight of God. Blessed is that man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. He has no fellowship, he has no communion, he has nothing in common with them. And if he has nothing in common with them, he will not associate with them. Why should he? So one then who disregards a vile person as a person that has nothing to do with them. And he wants nothing to do with them. He wants no fellowship with them. Psalm 26, verse number 5. I have hated the congregation of evildoers and will not sit with the wicked. So the writer here, a Psalm of David, says that he will have no association or fellowship with him. What concourse has Christ with Belial? What relationship is there between a believer and a non-believer? Certainly there is no spiritual one. Psalm 101, Verse number 3. I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. That is where he is catering to it, and it becomes a part of his thinking, it becomes a part of his life, and he enjoys it. He indulges in it, and he finds fellowship and enjoyment out of it. Psalm 119, verse 104. Through thy precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. I hate every false way. And that means that somebody whose lifestyle is predicated upon a false way, somebody who has made himself vile, who has become a vile person, will not be one that a child of God will want to associate with. There'll be no purpose and reason for it, because there's nothing in common there. Psalm 139, verse number 21. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am I not grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Now, I think if we understand this in the light of the gospel, New Testament, we're actually talking about hating their ways and what they do without hating the specific persons. I would say a good test to judge on that would be if you knew somebody that was really vile and rotten, and then they changed and became converted. Now, if they changed and really became a child of God and converted, and then you continued hating them all the rest of your life, even after they had made a change, that would show a real error in your thinking. But if you see somebody that's abhorrent, that really changes, and then when they change, you can accept him as a child of God, and you forget that past, that's the application of this principle. You hate their ways as long as they walk in those ways. Ephesians 5, verse 11. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. Have no fellowship with them. So, when you apply that text in Psalm 15, in whose eyes a vile person is disregarded or despised, that's exactly what you're talking about. You're not going to fellowship and have anything common with people who are vile in the sight of God. And that's people who are violators of his commandments and his laws, right and left. Then notice the next one here. But he honors them that fear the Lord. Psalm 15, verse 4. He honors them that fear the Lord. He has respect to those who love God and fear God. Psalm 119, once again, this time, verse number 63. I am a companion of all them that fear thee, of them that keep thy precepts. I'm a companion of those. Now, if you're a companion with somebody, obviously you do respect and honor them. So what it demonstrates here is the necessity to be sure that you cultivate your relationships with people who are like-minded and love God, and your closest friends are not these vile people in the world. If they are, then something has to be drastically wrong. Malachi 3, verse number 16. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another. They're having social relations, and they have a meeting of minds, and they do respect and honor one another. That's contrary to the way where if you find somebody that's trying to be a decent person who's mingling with those that are bad, I can absolutely guarantee that the good person is not going to bring the bad one up. What'll actually happen is the bad one will take the good one down. It always happens. So you should be careful who your friends are. You should be rather choosy. And you should choose people who think the way you think, if you think godly. If you don't think godly, I guess it doesn't make any difference. But if you're trying to obey God and want to be in His kingdom, then you'll be very choosy who your companions and your close friends are. Galatians 6, verse number 10. And look at it from this point of view, because if we're honoring those that fear God, what do we read here? And as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. We have special honor and respect for believers, for those who are of the same household of faith. Hebrews 10, verse number 24, and here's another way by which this is manifested. If we have love and respect and honor those who fear God, let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. And to good works. So we're in a proper frame of mind of giving and sharing and respecting and loving one another rather than being hateful and disrespectful and fault-finding and critical. Now this next one is significant because you find very few people who are willing to do this today, but this is a mark of character. What does it say here? He that swears to his own hurt and changes not. In other words, he makes a promise. He gives his word he's going to do something. And lo and behold, circumstances alter or change. And so what he's going to do ends up hurting him. And he will not change. He gave his word and he's going to keep it no matter what. That's a mark of character. Most people today, I think I could safely say the vast majority of humanity today, if they made some kind of a promise and then it turned against them, they would only keep that promise as long as they felt hurt. And as soon as they felt they were going to be hurt in it, they would discard it immediately. The man who's going to be in God's kingdom, he that swears to his own hurt and changes not. Now maybe he should be careful what he swears to. That is what he promises he's going to do. In fact, there's some admonitions here in the New Testament on that. And people sometimes get into jams because they are somewhat rash in what they promise and what they say. That's why one should be very careful what he promises. I've tried to tell my children over the years because they'll say, well, Daddy, now, will you do such and such? I'll tell them. I'll say, I'm not promising. If circumstances work out where I can do it, I'll do it. But now don't hold me to anything because I'm not promising you I'm going to do such and such. Notice what you read here in Matthew 5, verse number 33. Again, you have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thy oaths. This was Old Testament law. But here's what Jesus said. But I say to you, swear not at all. Don't take any oaths. Don't make any promises. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, neither shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. You know, people say, oh yes, I'll do it by the hair of my chinny chin chin. You've all heard that. That's an oath. That's where it comes from. They're swearing by their whiskers. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these comes of evil. So if you want to avoid swearing to your own hurt, then make it a practice of not making any kind of rash promises. But if you make one, you better keep it. You better be a man and a woman of your word. James 5, verse number 12. Here's another admonition concerning this. It says here, but above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. Just remember what we're told here in Ecclesiastes, the 5th chapter. Here's an admonition about people who make promises and then do not keep them. Let's get it here in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And verse number 4. When you vow a vow unto God, defer not to pay it. For he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not your mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. So you remember, it talks about somebody who makes a promise here in this 15th Psalm. He even swears to his own hurt, but he will not change. That's a man and a woman of character. And then notice what we read here next. He that putteth not out his money to usury. Now, do you think people do that? Well, the whole Babylonian system in which we live today is geared to usury. Excessive interest, and what it really means, primarily from the Bible viewpoint, it means taking interest on a charitable loan. That's what it means. In other words, you're giving somebody a loan that's a type of a charity, then you turn right around and take interest on it. That's usury from the Bible viewpoint. Notice Exodus 22, verse number 25. If you lend money to any of your people that is poor, it's a poor man, a charitable loan. Thou shalt not be to him as a usurer. Leviticus 25:35. If your brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. Yea, though he be a stranger or sojourner, that he may live with thee, thou shalt take no usury of him or increased, or unjust gain is what it means. You know, there are people, they'll just take advantage of somebody's hardship all the time. If you've ever been in the military service, you'll remember very well what happens when it gets down close to payday. These guys run out of cigarettes, and they'll start picking up snipes out of the street and smoking them. And they'll come around and hit up for loans, and there were guys that were loaning all the time. They say, all right, 5 for 10 on payday, 10 for 20 on payday. They charge them double. I could never do that. There were plenty of them that did. They had no qualms whatsoever. Yes, one that does not put his money out to usury, and then, as we read here, nor taketh reward against the innocent. In other words, he takes a bribe, and he'll pervert judgment for the sake of a bribe, or he'll be a false witness for some advantage he's going to gain over it. You think that's ever happened before? Why, the courts are full of it. If there's anything that's a big joke today, it's the whole judicial system. In fact, it's a part of a plot. Because it is what is called the seventh revolution. And it is a revolution to destroy confidence in the structure of government so a one world order can come in. All this whole judicial system that's been going on is deliberate. Very, very precise and clever planning behind it. To throw utter disrespect into law and order. So martial law can be declared and then these people can have their way. But as it says here, one thing God condemns anyone for is taking reward against the innocent. Notice Proverbs 14, verse number 25. Proverbs 14, verse number 25. A true witness delivers souls. He's not going to change his testimony no matter what. And he isn't going to be badgered, cajoled, bribed, or whatever to pervert judgment and to pervert justice. He's a man of his word. Proverbs 19, verse number 28, an ungodly witness scorns judgment. They don't care about who's hurt, and they don't care about who's wronged. Let's remember, we must never permit ourselves to ever be influenced for the sake of advantage in order to hurt someone else. That is absolutely wrong. So let's remember as we read here, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart. He that backbiteth not with his tongue nor doeth evil to his neighbor. Nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor. In his eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honors them that fear the Lord. He that swears to his own hurt and changes not. He that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent. He that doeth these things shall never be moved.